I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
That was President Bush on October 7th, 2001, announcing the first U.S. strikes in Afghanistan in retaliation for the attacks of September 11th, and thus began the longest war in American history, now under its third administration. Steve Call's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Ghost Wars, was about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 and the U.S. involvement in the region for the 20 years that followed. His new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, picks up where that book left off. Directorate S is a covert part of Pakistan's intelligence service that has supported the Taliban and other militant groups. Call writes that we are still there because the Bush and Obama administrations could not resolve essential questions about the conflict, and the Trump administration hasn't either. Steve Call is a staff writer for The New Yorker, also dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University, and just made it, joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I have to say, as I was reading through your book, I think I hit every emotion possible, mostly those emotions we associate with mourning and death. But I also wonder, what are we talking about when we talk, when we think about the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan today? Is this war? Is this occupation? Is this quagmire? Is this something that we haven't even defined yet?
Well, formally, it's a couple of wars. There's one now that the United States is fighting directly against a branch of the Islamic State that's popped up in eastern Afghanistan in the last couple of years. And then there's a second war, which is sort of advise and assist the Afghan security forces in their war against the Taliban. One of the entanglements that recurs in this 17 years is the United States being confused about what its place is at war against the Taliban. Even that first clip that you played,
right,
where Bush says, we're going to go after al-Qaeda. Okay, we all get that. They attacked us, but there were no Afghans on those planes. And the Bush administration from the very beginning was ambivalent about whether it wanted to go to war with Taliban. And I was struck by that language. I hadn't heard that clip in a while. That he said, we're attacking Taliban military installations, infrastructure. Really wasn't much of that. and he didn't say, we are going to defeat the Taliban. Previously they offered the Taliban a pass if they would turn over al-Qaeda. So this kind of ambiguity about our war with the Taliban was present from the very first week.
And you also say continued under the Obama administration.
Yes, it was a source of deep entanglement. In the first year of the Obama administration in particular, they were planning their strategy for the war. President Obama had campaigned, pledging to focus back on al-Qaeda and Afghanistan. And they went into these classified rooms to work out their strategy. And they could identify two vital interests that they thought the United States had in this war, interests that would justify sending young men and women into harm's way. One was al-Qaeda, which was still carrying out international attacks. The other was the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. But in 2009, neither of those problems was actually in Afghanistan. So then why are we going there? Well, the fear was that if the Taliban took over, al-Qaeda would come back. Makes sense, but it's a kind of indirect war. And then there was the question of, well, are the Taliban themselves the enemy?
Yeah.
And President Obama really did not want to fight a long war against the Taliban. He didn't think it was winnable on any timeline or at any acceptable cost. Even Robert Gates, who was a holdover from the Bush administration as defense secretary, said, look, the Taliban are part of Afghanistan. We're not going to just smash them into oblivion. But the Pentagon really did want to fight the Taliban. They thought that it was important to establish the constitutional government's longevity that way. And so they got into these arguments in the Situation Room. At one point, the White House side said, you know, we've never really promised to defeat the Taliban. The next day, the Pentagon came back with these PowerPoint decks full of statements by American leaders at various points of time, seeming to promise to defeat the Taliban, said, you may not want this war, but it's what you said you'd do.
But what you're saying, what your book is about, is that we don't know why we're there. Or maybe we perhaps had this notion about, obviously, after September 11th. And I have to say, I do remember shortly after those airstrikes, and when the Taliban seemed to be, being pushed from power, there was some sense of jubilation in Afghanistan, and I think a lot of Americans thought, we did the right thing.
Yeah.
We got rid of these people that were oppressing the Afghan people.
Very much so. And many Afghans came back because they wanted their country back. And their country had been at peace for most of the 20th century, stable, poor, but at peace with itself and its neighbors. And there was a generation of Afghans in exile who saw the fall of the Taliban as at last the opportunity to rebuild with international support. And the second section of the book is called Losing the Peace. And
yeah.
You know, I'm not a big believer in counterfactual history, but if you were to ask, when was there an opportunity to do better, it was then, in 2002, 2003, 2004. And not just because the Taliban were beaten and had mostly fled into Pakistan, but also because the restoration of Afghanistan with international support initially succeeded. I mean, Afghans themselves rewrote their constitution. They staged a successful presidential election, a successful parliamentary election. But we underinvested. We went off and fought a war in Iraq, and we were hubristic about the defeated Taliban, thinking they would never come back.
Let me ask you also about the CIA in Afghanistan. And you write, at CIA headquarters, desperation, fear, groupthink, pseudoscience, and misplaced faith in aggression, and the humiliation of enemy prisoners shaped the agency's program as it grew. Forward in Afghanistan, managerial incompetence, stupidity, and cruelty were the more important factors as Afghanistan looked more and more like a backwater without a significant al-Qaeda presence. And as the invasion of Iraq beckoned, the CIA increasingly deployed rookies, lightly experienced officers, and officers with troubled records at Bagram, Kandahar, and the Omega bases, basically saying because of what the CIA did in terms of the kind of torture that we have learned about, that was a, what, fatal mistake?
It was an important one. I mean, I tried to set the torture story in Afghanistan because I think a lot of the great journalism we've had about it has properly focused on the high-value prisoners they held offshore in different secret prisons. But, you know, in Afghanistan, it was a more prosaic, more brutal, thuggish kind of operation. And I tell the story of the murder of an Afghan prisoner in an obscure base way up in the northeast corner of the country by a CIA contractor who beat him to death, basically. And it was, it was an area where the leadership of the CIA was not paying attention. Everybody in Washington was focused on Iraq after late 2002. And the quality of people who wanted to go out to Afghanistan at that point kept diminishing, and there was no oversight. And then there was also a system of Afghan detention, which was almost as bad, even worse in some cases, than the CIA's facilities. So what's the consequence of this? Over those years, you had hundreds and hundreds of Afghan prisoners, many of them detained on the basis of hardly any evidence, treated poorly, and then they go home, and then they spread the word. You know, the Americans are just like the Soviets. And I think that ripple effect was important.
Well, just let me quote you one more time. You make a reference to this was as bad as MK Ultra, which was a CIA program in the 1950s, essentially using drugs on unwitting people who didn't know they were taking drugs as a way of trying to figure out, I guess, how the mind works.
Well, the parallel is this kind of pseudoscience, thinking that you can break people by applying psychology and psychological insights. And the CIA, look, the CIA doesn't detain people. That's not, they have no training in the course of being a career officer there in running a prison or carrying out interrogations. They had no manual for how to do it. They initially said, we don't want to do it. Give it to the Pentagon. That's what they do. Prisoners of war is their tradition. But they were so desperate for information from al-Qaeda that those who feared the next attack and who feared that they didn't know what they didn't know pressed to take certain prisoners into CIA custody. And then that just kind of snowballed.
Who or what is Directorate S? That's the title of your book.
Well, you described it correctly. It's the covert action arm of the Pakistani intelligence service known as ISI. And it has been a partner of the CIA going back to the 1980s. We really built up Directorate S in the war against the Soviet Union, where we ran guns and money to the Mujahideen guerrillas who were fighting the Soviet occupation. And then as ISI grew, swelled by these budgets, it became kind of a state within the Pakistani state. And it serves at the direction of the army, which is the most powerful institution in the country, is often ruled directly, but certainly rules indirectly even when it's not formally in dictatorship. And the army has always, has since the 1980s, used these Islamist radical groups that Director Das nurtures and keeps track of to menace India. And for Pakistan, really, it's all about India. And they feel like they're in a weaker position. They have a smaller population, smaller industrial base. They fear India seeks to destabilize or demilitarize Pakistan. And so the army uses these groups as a way to keep India off balance and to control its own neighborhood in Afghanistan. The Taliban, which are the most important client, so far as we're concerned, of ISI at the moment, the Taliban was an instrument of Pakistani army influence in Afghanistan. It shares a huge border with Afghanistan, and the people who live along the border don't respect its existence. And so the need to have a kind of forward defense through these militias was where the army landed.
I mean, something essentially the U.S. did not understand, this relationship between Pakistan and India, and then, of course, all the players within those three countries.
We underestimated the consequences of our own kind of indifference to the Taliban for our own future in Afghanistan, because after we defeated the Taliban in the fall of 2001 and Afghanistan was rebuilding and was at peace, we went off to war in Iraq. We turned security in Afghanistan over to NATO governments, and the Pakistani Army High Command looked at that decision and they said, "You're leaving this, you know, you're giving us our neighborhood back. Whatever it was you thought you were doing, you're on your way to something else. And so we need to get back to protecting our own interests, our own border." And they started to revive their support for the Taliban at that time. The other thing we did was to underestimate how central India was to the Pakistani calculus. Around this time, the United States cut a strategic nuclear deal with India, essentially forgave them for breaking out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and said to Pakistan at the same time, "You're not getting that deal. You're not reliable enough. You're a nuclear smuggler. It's not on the cards." And the Pakistanis said to themselves, "Well, you made yourself plain. You see our enemy as your strategic partner for the 21st century, and we're just, you know, rogue kids that you use and leave as you feel."
Was there, we're almost 7 to break, but was there some truth to that?
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Pakistan was an unreliable partner?
Well, yes, truth to that they were an unreliable partner, but also a failure to recognize that they would react that way and that the consequences might be dire for Afghanistan.
Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Steve Kahl. Again, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also dean in the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. His book, Ghost Wars, on the CIA's covert operations in that region, considered the definitive work on the subject, and it did win him a Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We spent about $1 trillion on this war. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Steve Kahl about his new book, Directorate S. Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet: did the CIA let the Taliban and Osama bin Laden escape from Tora Bora because it believed we would someday return to negotiating oil deals with them? A comment from David: we were swift to war. So much happened that year. I feel we were lied to. An email from Mike: did we, in effect, allow bin Laden to escape Tora Bora in favor of Tommy Franks turning towards Iraq? That gives you kind of a flavor. But obviously, this question about what happened at Tora Bora, can you answer that?
Yeah, so let's remind your listeners, this is December 2001. The Taliban are collapsing. Al-Qaeda flees to the mountains in the east where bin Laden operated in the 1980s. And he's up on this very high, very forbidding mountaintop. And the U.S. CIA sends Delta forces up to spot him, listen to his communications. They conclude that he's really there. And then the question is, will they block his escape into Pakistan by lifting troops up to close the back door? And Tommy Franks is the commander who's in charge of that decision. And he and his advisors decide that it's too dangerous and impractical to lift those forces up there. So bin Laden escapes into Pakistan, and lots of other al-Qaeda operatives escape and end up destabilizing Pakistan quite brutally over the next decade. So there's a big question of, could that have been prevented? Could the war have been ended there, since it was really bin Laden and al-Qaeda who attacked us on September 11th? And so I go back through it in great detail to try to wrestle with that question. And I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of military commanders who believe that the forces were there. It would have been risky. One of the factors that seems to have guided the decision not to act was a kind of misreading of Soviet experience in Afghanistan. There was a thinking that, well, if we put our own troops in big numbers up on that mountain, the local people will rise up and it'll be like Black Hawk Down times 10. And I think that was probably a misreading of what would have happened.
You think people would have supported it?
Well, I think they would have just gotten out of the way. Yeah. I mean, al-Qaeda was not rooted in those communities. I mean, it's not like you're going and attacking the head of a village. You're talking about Arabs, travelers, who have some, you know, connections with militants, but they're not rooted in those communities.
You also write in some detail about the fact that Osama bin Laden obviously hid out in Pakistan. Did the government in Pakistan know he was there? Were they protecting him? What were the involvement of his actual death there in Abbottabad?
Well, the circumstantial evidence is pretty damning. I mean, he was staying a mile from the Pakistan Military Academy, and he was there for a long time without being detected. There is also testimony from one of his wives that at least one of the times that they switched houses, there was a policeman in the vehicle with them. But it's not dispositive. I couldn't find absolute positive smoke and gun evidence that the Pakistanis knew. The Pakistani Army's high command, after bin Laden was exposed in Abbottabad in 2011, their defense was, yes, we really are that incompetent. We cannot find
that
every—
was their defense.
That was essentially to their own parliament, to their own press, and to the Americans who came to visit with them. And look, they'd say, we've been fighting a domestic insurgency with many terrorist cells for 10 years. The place is rife with these kinds of small groups that hide out in our midst. We had some people hiding right next to our army headquarters that we didn't know about for 6 months, and they attacked and killed some of our generals. So, you know, we are blind sometimes in our own country. That was their defense. You can take it as you will. But I think the circumstantial evidence on the other side is also, you know, pretty strong.
Are you agnostic?
I'm agnostic. I'm an evidence person. I mean, a couple of other very credible journalists have quoted anonymous sources saying, yes, they had a cell that helped him. I could not find sources that I thought were credible to say that. That doesn't mean that just could be my failure. Mm-hmm. I also read all the letters that were captured at Abbottabad that bin Laden wrote and have been translated since then. And it's interesting. He's very worried about the security forces, Pakistani security forces, catching his sons and wives as they travel to come stay with him, which he wants them to do. And it creates the impression that if there was a, you know, small group of deniable people who just helped him kind of settle in there and turn off his internet and burn his own trash and just say, you know, the message would have been, don't call us, we'll call you. I mean, they were not there to facilitate him from day to day, but they may have set him up in hiding and just said, you know, go to ground, you know, good luck.
Let me get Harry from, looks like Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And Harry, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. The record shows that U.S. interventions in other nations hasn't worked very well. And therefore, if we see conflict in a nation which impacts us, instead of invading, why not view it as a civil war and make our side simply supporting one side of the civil war, so we're allied with indigenous leadership rather than our direct invasion?
Well, Harry, would that it was so simple, but let me give Steve Call a chance to respond. Especially in this part of the world, it's hard to know which side are the good guys and which side.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually, I think what he says is more or less where the U.S. military has landed after a lot of failure in Iraq and Afghanistan, with big conventional army interventions and direct combat really not producing durable results. And so now they operate in much smaller groups, advising and assisting various indigenous forces. And they'll switch around as to which forces they're supporting. I mean, look, in Syria, we've had all different kinds of groups as our so-called allies, and And even now we're having to adjust because of what, you know, Turkey is doing in the war. So, yes, the basic doctrine these days is back to the Kennedy era of special forces, green berets, assisting indigenous forces, trying to stay flexible and learning the lesson that big conventional invasions of Muslim countries or really anybody else aren't going to succeed, especially in this era of saturated media and everyone being connected together. This is not the 19th century anymore.
But is that work? Does that work using more a smaller footprint, special forces? Is that a more effective approach?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you define success, I suppose. But in Afghanistan, it has produced an extension of the same stalemate that 150,000 international combat troops and 100,000 American troops produced in 2009, 2010. So the war is not changing. It's more or less the same map of a bloody stalemate between the Afghan forces and the Taliban forces. But the sacrifices are now being made by Afghan forces against the Taliban, not so much by Americans. And we can keep that war more or less stable, assuming politics in Afghanistan doesn't fall apart, by providing the Air Force that makes it impossible for the Taliban to really mass or take cities. Mm-hmm. The Taliban don't have an Air Force and they don't have any answer for our Air Force. So that's what the stalemate comes from.
But now, of course, the Afghanistan president, Ashraf Ghani, he wants to talk peace with the Taliban. He's offering to even forgive things like war crimes. So these are the people that we 17 years ago, you know, toppled. And now they're back. And they do control large swaths of Afghanistan.
Yes, depending on whose estimates you believe, between a quarter and three quarters, probably about half is good enough as an estimate. And, you know, the book has a thread of narrative about secret negotiations with the Taliban that the Obama administration attempted from 2010 until about 2013. It's a fascinating story. The Taliban do have political envoys who they send out to conduct these negotiations. The Obama team took some time to vet this candidate who the Taliban nominated for talks and decided, yeah, he was real and he proved it. And so they entered into negotiations about a possible settlement. All along, the idea was to get to where we were last week with this Kabul conference, where Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, you know, tried to signal to the Taliban that he was serious about talking. That is to say, a place where Afghans are negotiating with Afghans about possible outcomes. The Taliban are in an interesting position, or they've taken an interesting position as negotiators. One is they say, we only want to talk to you, the U.S. We don't want to talk to the Afghan government because they're just your quislings. They're your puppets. You're the real power. You're here militarily. You're the ones preventing us from coming back to power and restoring our righteous government. So let's just talk to you. And the Americans took that on during the Obama years for a little while in secret, figuring eventually they would broaden the group at the table to include other Afghans. Now we're really in a situation where all of the players in the region would have to be brought into a negotiation for it to have any effect. I think just one last thing about negotiations in this war. You know, the Taliban are abhorrent in many ways, and when they were in power, they were repressive and you know, medieval in some of their policies. But when you negotiate in a context of a civil war that's stalemated like this, you know, outcomes that are good for the country are not limited to a beautiful peace settlement all tied up in a bow and announced in a ceremony with flags and flowers. Sometimes you can just reduce the violence. Sometimes you can just keep civilians out of the way. I was just reading a long couple of books about the history of the Lebanese civil war. It was very interesting. Two parties in that conflict that would never reconcile with one another, won't for 50 or 100 years, Hezbollah and the State of Israel, nonetheless negotiated in secret for years to prevent attacks on their civilians. So lots of Israelis who lived within Hezbollah rocket range were left alone, and lots of Lebanese Shia civilians in southern Lebanon were left alone by Israel. And Israel and Hezbollah just agreed to fight military to military for years. And so this was an unannounced result of negotiations, but it created space for families and communities to thrive for a generation. Now, you know, in Afghanistan, it's the civilians who are suffering the most. So have any path towards reducing their exposure to violence is a good one.
Do we know how many civilians have died in the last 17 years?
I mean, tens of thousands and thousands now every year. You know, the violence has unfolded since we went in on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border. Between 2007 and 2014, I mean, Pakistan descended into the worst period of terrorism in its history. Tens of thousands of people died, civilians, security forces, guerrillas, as a result of the destabilization of our intervention. And then in Afghanistan, it's been just continuous since 2004. Where we are today is that Pakistan has finally kind of gotten a grip on its domestic security. The army has really cracked down. And one of the things they've done is kind of push the trouble back into Afghanistan. So at the moment, things are worse in Afghanistan. You see these mass casualty attacks in Kabul, the big truck bombs and the like. And so it's a very difficult time.
Is the trouble the Taliban or like-minded?
Yeah, I think the UN groups. UN does analysis about casualties and civilian casualties, and they attribute the majority of the civilian casualties to the Taliban and like-minded group.
That's Steve Call, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars and his new book, Directorate S, subtitled The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. Lots of comments here, Radio Times. At WHYY.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I get the feeling from reading your book that you say U.S. policy should focus more on Pakistan, that what happens between the U.S. and Pakistan, and perhaps even inside Pakistan, might be more important than Afghanistan. And let me read what our president tweeted on New Year's Day. 7:12 a.m. The United States has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they've given us nothing but lies and deceit, thinking our leaders as fools. They gave safe haven to terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little help, no more. Now, since that time, there's been some question about how much money has actually gone to Pakistan or not, but how do you see U.S.-Pakistan relations, especially under our current president?
Well, you know, he's expressing frustration there that runs deep into the U.S. national security bureaucracy and has for years in the Army and CIA and other places because, for understandable reasons, Directorate S, the ISI, has suckered and supported and created sanctuary for groups, primarily the Taliban, but others that have crossed continuously into Afghanistan and attacked and killed American soldiers. So if you're an American soldier fighting the counterinsurgency war in 2010, 2011, slogging through the green zone of Kandahar, for example, or a U.S. Marine in Helmand, and you know you check your paycheck every day and you look at the taxes that have gone out and you reflect on it, well, some portion of those have gone across the border to fund a government that is supporting the very people who are out there shooting at you after breakfast. So it was a pretty dark entanglement. And the dilemma was that the United States did not have the leverage and was to some extent deterred by Pakistan's own instability to put too much pressure on the country. It looked like it was falling apart. It had 100-plus nuclear weapons. The prospect of one of those bombs getting to one of the many radical groups that reside in Pakistan was understandably concerning. So as long as Pakistan looked like it was really collapsing, the Obama administration shared the frustration that President Trump expressed but was reluctant to act because it was afraid it would make a bad situation worse. Mm-hmm. Now, the Trump administration has the luxury of a Pakistan that's more stable than it was, and so trying to go back and put some pressure on it is not, you know, an insane idea. But the problem is, A, there's a long history of imposing sanctions on Pakistan to try to change its conduct. It's never worked. And B, if there were a path to try to change the situation, it would have to combine pressure with negotiations. And it's really not clear that the Trump administration is built to do that sort of thing.
But you seem to say that China could play a role.
Yes.
With Pakistan.
China's Pakistan's most important ally. And
really?
Pakistan is actually China's most important ally. It doesn't have a lot of allies in the world.
What is the connection there?
Well, it goes back to the Cold War when Pakistan and China saw common interests against the axis of India and the Soviet Union. China went so far as to really nurture Pakistan's nuclear program to offset India's nuclear program once that developed in the 1970s. And you remember, Pakistan also maintained good relations with the United States during that period because we were also opposed to the Soviet Union and even to India in those years. And so it was Pakistan that brokered Nixon's opening to China in the 1970s. It was Pakistan that allowed the U.S. to fly U-2s secretly over the Soviet Union to spy on Soviet positions. So Pakistan has always tried to have both relationships work well, but the change now is we are estranged because of the events of, you know, 2011, 2012, and China is a much bigger player in the world than it ever was, right? So to have China as your best friend means a lot more than it used to 20 or 30 years ago. And so with the pressure the Trump administration is putting on Pakistan, what you see Pakistan doing in response is just nesting inside its relationship with China. China has always covered for Pakistan at the UN and in the international system. Now, China is not naive. It knows that Pakistan is also dysfunctional. China doesn't want to support Islamist militancy. It has its own problems domestically. And it would like Pakistan to be a better country, and that would make for their partnership more important. So you see China kind of playing around right now with different strategies about how to get Pakistan into the mix for a peaceful, more stable future in Central Asia. After all, that's China's neighborhood. That's where China's economic future lies. For example, China just last week or 2 weeks ago declined to back Pakistan in a kind of meaningless but symbolic program of sanctioning countries that don't do enough to cut off money to terrorists. Now, normally China would veto something like that, but they let it go. And they're signaling also that they want these peace negotiations to proceed. How much will they really invest in it? That's the question. They've always said that they want these things, but then they don't use their full power to make it come about.
Well, we are talking about a complicated part of the world with Steve Call. And again, he's got a new book. It's called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a kind of a sequel to a previous book that he wrote called Ghost Wars. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just recap here. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani wants to talk peace with the Taliban. In fact, offered to forgive their war crimes and allow the Taliban to become a legitimate political party in an effort to end the almost 17 years of fighting. Our guest Steve Call has been covering Afghanistan both before and after September 11th. And again, his new book is Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Panos. Let's not forget our military is guarding the poppy fields there. Think there's any correlation to the opiates and heroin epidemic here in the United States? Then he brings up the Contras and Ronald Reagan, which I think is for a whole other discussion here. But let's talk about how much Afghanistan is a place where poppies are grown and sold.
Yeah, it's one of the world's main sources of opium and therefore heroin. And at one point, the growth of poppy crops during the U.S. war was so great that Afghanistan could supply an annual budget of the world's heroin consumption. Mm. And it's been a subject of argument and secret debates inside two administrations, at least, and probably now in the Trump administration as well. What do you do about it? Because if you attack the farmers that grow the poppy in southern Afghanistan, what you're really doing is just poking a bee's nest with a stick, and you're guaranteeing that farmers and laborers who are already marginalized, just barely eking out an existence, are going to be motivated to take up arms. At the same time, if you don't do something about the Taliban's access to finance, the studies of civil wars of this kind show that when a guerrilla group has the kind of sanctuary in Pakistan that the Taliban enjoys and can self-finance, the wars just go on for a very, very long time. So it's not a problem anyone has solved, but it's another one of those things in the Afghan war where just about every approach has been tried at one time or another, It hasn't really produced results.
Is Afghanistan in any way better off now than it was in the year 2000? Is there any way to
Yes, it is. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the cities are new places, and there's a generation of young people that have come up in the cities in Afghanistan who are connected to the world and nationalistic and have a vision of Afghanistan's future that's very inspiring to be around. And they've made enormous sacrifices to hold on to this vision because of the insecurity caused by this war. And, you know, when you say the war is a bloody stalemate, you have to acknowledge first that it's now Afghan security forces who are making the sacrifices, and they're defending something that's real, which is this generation that's come of age in the cities primarily since 2001.
But it doesn't sound as if there is a military solution, or there has to be some kind of diplomacy or some version of diplomacy.
There's no military solution in sight. You know, I suppose, you know, if you fought the war for 30 or 40 years, maybe one side or the other would collapse. The problem isn't just that the war is stalemated on the battlefield. It's also that Afghan politics are a mess. So our friends, Ashraf Ghani, they're not united. They're not functioning as a unified government. There's a lot of polarization, ethnic polarization, and political factionalism that has hindered the effectiveness of the Afghan government in lots of ways, including militarily. So there are, you know, people I respect in Afghanistan on the other side of the war from the Taliban who are really ardent nationalists, and they just say, we just have to fight until we win. Mm. But that would be a more convincing argument if Afghan politics wasn't such a mess and if there were really any path to visualize a unified anti-Taliban Afghanistan. And right now, we don't have that.
So if Ashraf Ghani is saying, I'll sit down with the Taliban.
Who's he speaking for? This is the problem with the negotiation. So, you know, ultimately, if there are already Taliban who have defected and come in from the cold and formed political parties or Taliban allies. There are ex-Taliban ministers living in Kabul. There are ex-militants sitting in parliament. This is the way these things happen. You try to get people to defect, put mm-hmm. down their arms and come into politics, even if you disagree with everything they believe. That's the way to peace. But it has to be acceptable to a majority of Afghans. It has to be sustainable. It can't trigger another round of civil war. It can't be a deal that leaves whole sections of the Afghan population angry and ready to fight. So ultimately, there has to be a negotiation that's inclusive of diverse points of view in Afghanistan. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to love it at the end of the day, but it has to be stable enough to hold.
Let me read some more comments. One from Annabelle. The war has evolved into damage control, trying to keep Taliban and ISIS from regaining power. Afghanistan is the new Vietnam. Is it the new Vietnam or a version of Vietnam?
I mean, the parallels are there. And, you know, a lot of Americans who were involved in the Afghan war resisted them, but they're hard to evade. Excuse me. I watched the Ken Burns documentary last fall, and I was just stunned after so many years of work on this book and to see how parallel some of the themes of especially American decision-making were. You know, there was a time when the Obama administration came in and they appointed Richard Holbrooke as their main envoy to the Afghan war. And Holbrooke had started out as a Foreign Service officer in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta. And he used to mention Vietnam in the Obama White House, and it really irritated the president. I mean, he found Holbrooke irritating for a bunch of reasons, but he especially didn't like hearing about Vietnam. And I was talking to Holbrooke at that time, and when I was working on the book, I went back through the transcripts. He died at the end of 2010, and we were having a conversation. Holbrooke had just come out of the White House, and he was mortified that he had, you know, irritated President Obama by again talking about Vietnam, and he admitted that he had, you know, kind of goofed in this way. And then he said, they shouldn't be so scared of history. He was right about that.
Yes, indeed. A tweet from Christopher. The genesis of all these problems was 1991 after the first Gulf War, when the first George Bush decided it would be a good idea to start building U.S. military bases all over Muslim lands. That caused 9/11 and all the ensuing conflicts. What do you think of that?
Well, it gets back to that familiar question after 9/11, you know, why do they hate us? And certainly it's important to have an honest conversation about how our foreign policy figures in that. So the basing of the United States in the Middle East has mostly evolved into a partnership with these very small, very wealthy oil states along the Persian Gulf, right? So that's our those are where our big bases are, and there we function as a kind of Brinks guard force for small, undemocratic, family-based wealth, and in exchange for protecting their access to their own oil or their ownership of their own oil, we have these bases from where we can fly all over the region. And that's been the basis for interventions in Syria, and that's how we've supported the war in Afghanistan and in Yemen and other places. You know, a question about the future of Afghanistan is whether the United States military is really going to argue to this president and to future presidents that we must have bases in Afghanistan, because this is something that is really critical to the possibility of a regional settlement with, you know, China and Iran and Pakistan and others supporting a new Afghanistan that is not at war with itself. Because the Taliban are very clear, you know, you cannot occupy this country. You know, it's very funny, in the secret negotiation during the Obama administration, this envoy from the Taliban, Tayyip Aga, he would say, you have to get out eventually, but don't go too fast, because we don't want to collapse back into a civil war. We might need you as peacekeepers for a little while. So there's a practical strain to Afghan thinking about their own kind of future. How can we avoid going back to the terrible wars of the 1990s from which the Taliban emerged?
I mean, it seems like we get jerked around. That might not make exactly the right word, but kind of it feels that way.
Yeah.
By all the players and forces.
Well, we put ourselves there, and then we create anxiety for everybody around Afghanistan. I mean, the Chinese will look at us, and they are sort of comfortable with, we're carrying out a counterterrorism mission. They benefit from that. We're willing to spend the money and take the military risk. But the Iranians look at our bases there and say, well, they're really there to attack us. You've got us surrounded on both sides, and you're not shy about saying you want a different government. And Pakistan, after the raid on Abbottabad, feels the same way. And they're right. The U.S. keeps a military counterterrorism presence in Afghanistan partly so that it can reach Afghanistan with helicopters and that sort of thing, and drones, which is the one thing you couldn't do if you just fell back to your bases in Qatar and the UAE.
That's Steve Call, our guest, and we're talking about his new book called Directorate S. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Tell us about Tim Hopper.
He was a lieutenant at the time who was in an artillery unit. He was in the coming out of a tour in Korea, and he was sent to southern Afghanistan to lead a platoon in one of the worst fights of the American war, in an area called the Green Zone, an irrigated area west of Kandahar City, where, especially in the summer, it was just thick with grape orchards and high walls and 10-foot marijuana plants, one of the most forbidding landscapes for infantry combat you could imagine in the world. And he wrote a diary of his experience in his platoon, which lost, I think, something like 60 or 80% of their men had to be replaced, either from deaths or severed limbs or concussions. And they had to basically, the Taliban were embedded in this green zone, and they had to basically, and had built booby traps in every direction, and they had to go basically walk out on patrol until they made contact with the Taliban and try to clear them out. And it was a very costly fight. And this platoon in particular, Tim Hopper's platoon, was not even trained for it. They were an artillery unit and having now to do something they'd never done before. And it was a harrowing 6 months. But his diary is a thing of great beauty, and he was very kind to share it with me. And you really get a feel for what was being asked of these men and women on behalf of these policies that they were so entangled with contradictions. It was an opportunity to locate the book, you know, where the costs were really paid, which was on the ground.
Let me read a couple of things that he wrote in one of his diaries. He said, "Damn, what did I get myself into here? I'm not a tactical genius. I'm smart, but this doesn't come naturally to me. I keep trying to put myself in the mindset of the Taliban, but I can't seem to wrap my head around it. Regardless of whether I feel like I'm ready or not, I'm being thrust into this, and I do not have a choice. My life is going to be on the line in the next month or so. I've decided I'm going to write a death letter for my parents, Jenny, and my brother. I know it's morbid, but I think it's probably a good thing to do just in case anything happens." I mean, it just moves me to tears.
Yeah. It's, and you know, this, spoiler alert, he survives. But it's an amazing account of other deaths and his comrades. And, you know, because of this task of going out on foot patrol in this booby-trapped, nightmarish landscape, they would rely on their most experienced sergeants who had done multiple tours in IED-infested places in Iraq and Afghanistan to walk point every day. And there's this one guy named Josh Strickland in Hopper's platoon who is a genius at detecting booby traps. And he walks like 10, 15 feet in front of everybody because if he makes a mistake, he says, I just want one person to pay for it, not three. Huh. And he gets blown up four times, medevac to Kandahar airfield each time. The doctors each time say, do you want to go home or do you want to go back? And he says, well, I got to go back. Yeah. And eventually he makes it through as well. But the environment, 120 degrees Fahrenheit, carrying, you know, 70, 80 pounds of gear and just walking into a random contact. They're called presence patrols. Your purpose is just to provoke a fight with the Taliban that are in the fields.
And as he says, I don't really know what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here, but I don't know what I'm doing.
Yes. I mean, literally, tactically, and also, you know, they had such a sense of honor and duty to one another. And, you know, you don't see a lot of questioning of the kind of strategy, but it starts to build. And I think a lot of veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan came home, you know, in the period 2014, 2015, when you look at the disillusionment with our elites and the anger that was in the country in 2016, both on the Bernie side and on the Trump side, you know, I think all those families, especially in those states that produce the volunteers, Pennsylvania is one of them,
absolutely,
you know, and Ohio and the South, you know, all those families, they knew that they had been misled by their leaders and that they had sacrificed, but that the people above them hadn't really performed as honorably. So I think that it changed our politics.
Well, your two books, Ghost Wars and this one in the subtitle, Secret Wars. I mean, these are wars that we don't talk about very much.
Mm.
Doesn't get much news play anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they are kind of ghost wars in many ways.
Yeah. And the consequences for the Americans who fight them are also hidden in many ways. I mean, in Afghanistan, for example, you look at the casualty structure, you know, the way battlefield medicine has evolved, it's easier to survive being in combat than it was in Vietnam, for sure. And partly it was a commitment of the U.S. military to try to get to everyone as fast as possible and give them the best attention. So we lost a few thousand deaths in the Afghan war, but 20,000 wounded. And the number of people who lost limbs because of this fight that involved all these IEDs and suicide bombers, just staggering how many people came home alive but broken.
Yeah. This is your second book about this part of the world. Is there a third book?
I think I'm going to have to leave that task to the next generation.
Why? Just because this is hard? It's hard to write about?
Very hard work. I mean, that book was based on 550 interviews, a decade of work, a lot of travel to the region. Right. And it ties off a body of work that began with my being kind of randomly assigned to that part of the world by the Washington Post as a foreign correspondent. But I think this is another 10 or 15 years before the third volume is available. And by that point, I may not be a candidate for helicopter rides in the Panjshir Valley.
When was the last time you were in Afghanistan?
A year ago, September, I went over to get the epilogue of the book. And, you know, Kabul has really – I was going steadily during the years of research for this book, say from 2006 to 2016. But Kabul has really become a much less secure place than it was even at the height of the combat. There's a kidnapping problem. They've got these terrorist attacks. So it's a rough place.
Steve Call, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
And absolutely. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
It's called Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he's a staff writer for The New Yorker, dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.